حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. الحمد لله الذي هدانا لهذا وما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله. والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله الحكيم في كتابه المتين، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، ولقد كان لكم في رسول الله أسوة حسنة. صلوات على محمد وعلى آله.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
The subject is the seerah, the history, the life of the Prophet. And as we are discussing, basically history of the Prophet's life, it is important to keep in mind the objective of knowing the seerah and the history of the Prophet. It shouldn't be that we just regard it as historical stories and hear it just to gain more information. But the seerah of the Prophet and his sunnah is a part of our faith. And we gain knowledge of it so that it could be implemented in our lives and it could be made a part of our lives in how we think, how we understand things, and how we analyze ourselves and the situations and circumstances that we live in. Just to give you an idea of what it means, what the sunnah means. There is a hadith from the Prophet that is recited in the khutbah of nikah. And this khutbah that we recite of nikah every time, that's written in our books, it was recited by our ninth imam, Imam Muhammad al-Jawad alayhi salatu wassalam.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
He recited the khutbah for his own marriage to the daughter of Mamun. And hence, just to keep alive that sunnah, we recite the same khutbah. And in that khutbah, he mentions the hadith of the Prophet, in which he has mentioned, "An-nikahu min sunnati." "Haman raghiba an sunnati falaysa minni." He says that nikah, marriage, is from my sunnah. And whoever turns away from my sunnah is not from me. So this hadith is an equation, an argumentation, an establishment of proof. You see that it has two statements and two parts. The first part, we see the messenger is saying, that marriage is from my sunnah, and nikahu min sunnati. Right, that marriage is from my sunnah. So this is a statement that he's making to show that this is from my sunnah. Then he gives another statement, which is a statement of principle. He says that whoever turns away from my sunnah is not from me. So in other words, whenever you find out something is the sunnah of the Prophet and it's the seerat of the Prophet, and if you turn away from it, then you're not from me. So in equation, right, when we see those who know, and I'm sure everyone has read algebra, basic algebra, not calculus, advanced calculus, right? You're just going through the basic formula of algebra. When you have an equation like A is equal to B and B is equal to C, where you have A is equal to B on one side and B is equal to C on the other side, then in order to reach a conclusion, you remove the two common factors on both sides, which is B. And then you reach the conclusion that A is equal to C. Right? That is, you know, the most basic formula of algebra. So now when you see in this hadith the equation that he's giving, he's making it clear that an-nikahu min sunnati. Nikah is from my sunnat. And whoever turns away from my sunnat is not from me. So on this side you have the word sunnah, and in this side you have the word sunnah. So if you get rid of that, then it means that those who don't marry, they're not from me. So any time a sunnah is established, that you know that this is the sunnah of the Prophet, this is the seerat of the Prophet, if you turn away from it, then it means that you cease to be from amongst the Prophet. Right? And this is the reason why when we are learning the seerah of the Prophet, it is highly important and necessary that when we establish that this is the seerah of the Prophet, then this should be our way of life and we should not turn away from it. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Now, as you see, the seerah and the sunnah of the Prophet is established in many things. In how he worshipped, how he lived his life, how he treated others, how he interacted with friends and foes. And as we are discussing right now, also in how he propagated Islam. What we are establishing here is the seerah or the sunnah of how to propagate Islam as the Prophet had done. And so now if we want to also work for Islam and propagate Islam, then we must follow the sunnah that the Prophet has established. If we turn away from it, if we do not do the way that he has done, then we might be working, but our work will be fruitless. Because anything that goes against the sunnah of the Prophet is going to be fruitless and without any fruits. In order to establish the seerah, we must first of all understand it and then implement it the way the Prophet did it. So when we are learning about how to do tabligh and da'wah and propagating Islam, it must be done the way the Prophet had done it, because he's the one who showed how to do it. He's the one who showed how to do it. We cannot just make up our own ways and say that this is how we're going to do it. Right? Because the way he has done it is the way that must be established. I mean, we can't say that, well, in his time, you know, in his time there was no abortion. No, there was. It was worse. Right? Here, at least, you know, you don't see the baby being killed. There you saw the baby, held the baby in your hand and then killed it. You know, so now which one was a worse society? Here, yes, is a time of ignorance where, for example, women have been made into objects of achieving material things. Right? In those days, women were regarded as material things. At least here, they are regarded as humans. There, they weren't even regarded as humans or equals. They were regarded as products, right, to be sold and bought. So, obviously, the time that he did, he propagated Islam, was a time that was worse than what we have today. Was a time that is worse than what we have today. I mean, here you see you have arrogance. Right? You have arrogance, right? The superpowers are very arrogant. Right? They're very arrogant. But you see, their arrogance is no match for the arrogance of the chiefs of Makkah. You know, I mean, if one of these guys get hurt, right? I explained to you last week, if they get hurt, right, then they will go to the hospital to get treatment. Right? Now if you remember Ali's story from last week, when he got hurt, just because of his arrogance, he wouldn't take care of himself. He would rather die but bend and take out that thorn. You see, that was the state of arrogance. They would rather die than to bend down. Right? And so you see that the time of the Prophet was much worse. Right? And he did propagate Islam and he showed us how it's done. He showed us how it's done. Some principles we can learn from it. That if we want to work for Allah's cause and if we want to propagate Islam and give the message of Islam to people, if we understand that obligation, but Allah clearly has informed us and He has made it clear in the Quran that it is an obligation for Muslims to propagate the message of Allah when they have the chance and opportunity to do so. Allah says, "Udu'u ila sabila rabbika bil hikmati wal mu'idati al hasana." Udu'u is a command. You know, call, invite to the way of Allah. So obviously, this is an obligation for us that we have to do that. And then how do we do it? The way the Prophet has done it. Now from there, we learn certain things that we should keep in mind. When the Prophet began his work, right, and I want you all to understand this, if you want to work, if you want to preach, if you want to give the message of Islam, or if you want to train people and tell them what's right and wrong, then you need to remember this as a principle. When you propagate Islam, or when you, for example, look at the life of the Prophet as he was propagating Islam, everyone who was in Makkah knew certain things about the Prophet. They testified to his character. They testified to his speech, and they testified to his actions. You see, they had said that he is Sadiq, meaning that he's honest. Everyone testified to that. And they all testified to the fact that he is Ameen and trustworthy. Being Sadiq or honest is a testimony of his speech. Being trustworthy is a testimony of his actions. Meaning in both in speech and actions, they knew that he is upright, that he is righteous, and he will not make any wrong statement or would do anything wrong. They knew that. In fact, after he claimed Islam to the people and they hated him for that, they still brought their trust and their wealth to keep it in his hands because they knew that he would not do wrong with it. So they trusted him. They knew him. But then, and they knew him for his whole life. His whole life he lived in Makkah and they knew him. They knew his character. They testified to his character. But the question is now, that after looking at his character, and after knowing his character, and after testifying to his character, why is it that when rumors were spread about him, it was so easy for people to be beguiled by those rumors? I mean, look at it. You'll see. They spread rumors about the Prophet and said he is, for example, a magician. And everyone said, he's a magician. That's a magician. You know what I mean? You know him for your whole life. And just one rumor comes around, you didn't even see him yourself. Right? One rumor comes around, you believe it. What kind of an attitude is that? See, understand, there is a principle we are being taught here. And this happens to everyone who preaches the truth. If you want to say the truth, if you want to say something right, then this is what's going to happen to you. If you want to say something right. That no matter if the people know you so well, they know you so well that, you know, he is upright, we know he is that, we know what kind of person he is, everything. But when you start speaking the truth, then you see the same people are going to forget their experience they had with you for your whole life, and they will trust those rumors. Don't trust those rumors. And it happens. For example, you know me. How long have you known me? We have been together through thick and thin. And journeys, we lived together, we did all these things. And you know me. Now for example, right? If, right? It's one thing that if a person came and said, I saw him doing haram. See, even that's not the case. You hear it in the newspaper that there's an accusation that he was, for example, in this place and he was doing wrong. Where it was. So understand me. Are we going to say that, oh, look at this, and we thought we knew him. We thought we knew him. Meaning, that rumor became so important that our testimony, our own experience, and our own knowledge is useless in front of that rumor. The whole knowledge, we have knowledge of someone. This is our knowledge. We saw it with our eyes. In our life experience, we had that experience. But a rumor was spread, and you see that, that's it. We start believing it. Why is that? My friends, this happens when a person says the truth, because you see, the truth mostly is against the interest of people. The secret is that when you say the truth, it's against the interest of people. When it goes against their interest, so now they want to believe in anything that will put down that thing that goes against their own interest. See, if I wasn't saying anything right, if I was saying that, listen, you know, let's make bayat to the superpower here. Right? And so now, even rumors happen, they say, no, we can't be the good guy. You know, he's good. But then now, because we say the truth, and we say that, no, this guy is a bully and an oppressor, everyone's like, you know, he's making our life hard here. So any chance we have, let's put him down. See, this is what happens. In anywhere you go, this is what happened. What the Prophet faced. So, for those who want to work for Islam, who want to work for Allah, who want to work for the truth, then the life of the Prophet and the propagation of the Prophet is a consolation and a comfort for anyone who's working for Islam. So that they can look back at the Prophet and say, if the Prophet had to go through this, then who am I? I need to do more. If rumors were made about him, if wrong was told about him, then imagine this. This is something that we can understand. And his life is a seerah. Why? That comforts us. To know that he went through that, now it became a seerah. We need to expect it, that this is going to happen in our life also. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
So that's the first lesson you learn, my friends. The second lesson that we learn from the seerah of the Prophet. Right? And I want you to understand this. When you are living in a corrupted society, in a society that's filled with evil and immorality, and you want to speak the truth in a society like this, any community also, that is evil and corrupted, you want to say the truth there. And if you do say it, obviously there's going to be reaction And those people will do something either through word or through hands to stop you any way that they can. It's happening. Right? This is the case. But understand something, my friends. Whenever fitna is created, because there will be fitna, you say something, there's going to be fitna. And they're going to call and they're going to, you know, get angry and, you know, everyone's going to get upset. But always know one thing, right? Kufr never starts the fitna. It's always Muslims who start the fitna. Understand this, my friends. Understand well, we learn it from the seerat of the Prophet. Makkans did not start the fitna, it is the Prophet who started the fitna. It is the Prophet who started the fitna, and he showed us that if you are following my seerat, it will be you who will always start the fitna. Why? Because if you are in a ship that's headed the wrong way, then you have two choices. Either you can let it go, or you can tell them we are going wrong. Right? You only have two choices. If you say let it go, then you have to compromise your faith with Allah. And if you don't want to compromise your faith with Allah, then you have to say something. And if you say something, then there is going to be reaction.
Allahu Akbar.
You see, there is going to be reaction. That's, as a mu'min, we are going to be the ones who will always cause that. Because we can't just sit around and say something wrong happening. We have to say something about it. This is the part, this is the seerah of the Prophet. He showed, if he didn't say anything to the Makkans, life would have gone on. If he didn't say anything, no one would have minded. Nothing would have happened. Life was going well for everyone. But the Prophet showed that being a mu'min, and the sign of iman is that iman cannot tolerate kufr and evil happening. It has to say something. No matter how nice you say it, it doesn't matter. Yes, we are told that when you do it nicely. Mu'izzat al-hasana, hikmah, wisdom, and a good manner, do it. No matter how nicely you do it, you cannot do it more nicely than the Prophet. You can't do it more nicely than the Prophet. And when he did it in his special way of being nice and lenient, there still was problems. There still is problems. So if you are working for Islam, you have to understand that you will be the root of the problems. It does happen. And that's why you see that. Why? Because we will be the first one to throw the stone and say that, hey, listen, this is wrong. When you say this is wrong, this is not happening, no matter how nicely you say it. Of course, you don't want to go there and make problems, right? By saying things in a way that are just making the people stubborn and angry. No, you want to say it in a way or do it in a way that is good. But still there will be problems. Because the society is batil. Right? The society is batil. That's why. You see, if I say the truth here in this room, then you all are saying Subhanallah. If I say the truth here, you all say Subhanallah. There's nothing wrong. Everyone's saying Subhanallah and Nare Hedri and all that. Right? So if I say the truth here, nothing's going to happen. Why? Because the reason there's nothing happening or there's no reaction that is angry is because everyone here believes in the truth. We are talking about living in a society that is evil and corrupted. And trying to rectify that society, you are going to have reaction. And it is going to cause fitna. This is what we learn from the seerah. Second thing we learn from the seerah of the Prophet. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala alihi. Now the third thing, my friends, and these are things that if we are working for Allah's cause, we must realize these things and know that these things are happening. The third thing, my friends, is that one of the ideas that many people have who are Muslims or become Muslims and want to see change or see a revolution, you know, they feel that, you know, in order to do a revolution, that they need to be loud, they need to be public, they need to declare themselves openly and let everyone know that this is happening. Right? They need to let everyone know that this is happening and this is the way it is. Right? Go out and, you know, put like big, huge billboards on the highway saying 1-800-Y-Islam. And buses and taxis. Right? So they feel that it's necessary to go out and make everything public. Right away. That's how we need to do it. Get it out in the face of the people. Show it in their face. If you want to dunk, dunk it in their face. But the Prophet showed differently. He said that no. First 3 years of his prophethood was done in secrecy. He was told to propagate secretly. Underneath. Just get those people who are open-minded, who are able to think, and make them think and get them to Islam. Do it in a hidden way. Not in a way that is, for example, going to be openly in public. Why? You see, this is also he showed us, so that we can learn from this. The reason he said it is because there needs to be groundwork done before a building can be built. There needs to be groundwork that is done before the building can be built. You don't have no foundation, you have no people who think like you, then when you go up alone and start shouting, then people will be not on the same frequency as you. They'll look at you and say, what's wrong with this guy? They don't even understand what you're saying. And hence you see Prophet propagated secretly. Why? So that he can create the grounds in the grassroots of the people. Get that thinking across. So that when he declares Islam, then there is that idea in the minds of the people that this might be true. This might be true. Without that, you cannot have it. And this is the reason that for us who are trying to propagate and trying to give the message, our job is not to go on Oprah and the media and this and that. I told you that. This is not the way to do it. You don't go on a venue that is just for entertainment. Right? You want to go to the people who are going to get that message. Get them to understand first. Get them on your side so that the people who know what we are about, what Islam is about, they grow. This is what the Prophet had done. And he had done it for 3 years in Makkah. And the 3 years that he was in Makkah, and he was propagating silently, hiddenly, propagation was going on. No one knew it was happening. At least openly. You know, and in the 3 years, people began to realize, hey, wait a minute, there's a change happening. In Makkah, there are people who are realizing that there's a change happening here. You know, our children are thinking differently. They're acting differently. You know, they're not acting like us anymore. You know, because us were the chiefs of Makkah, they were acting arrogantly. And they saw their children change and they will act modestly and humbly. I say, what's wrong with you acting like that, girl? Act like a man. You know? See, it's different because it's an environment of ignorance. And hence when a man who's humble is disliked. What's wrong with this guy? Right? Because it's ignorance. So now when they saw people acting differently, they knew something is going on. They knew there's someone who's, you know, teaching different manners to our people. But they didn't know who it was. They didn't know where it was coming from. But they knew it was there. It was the talk of the town, especially in the third year. It was the talk of the town. Everyone was like asking, you know, what's going on here? Who's doing all these things? And they didn't know who was behind it. They really didn't know who was behind it. Until the incident of the mountain happened. And the Prophet came on the mountain and he announced to the people about Islam and that he's the messenger of Allah. When they heard that, now they knew who is behind the problems that we are having. Who is behind the misguidance? Now they knew. And at the time the Prophet announced it, obviously the Prophet did not, there was no angry reaction towards him. The only one who said anything to the Prophet at that point was his uncle, Abu Lahab. He is the only one who said it, because he already knew the message, right? That's why he said it. Right? I mean, he said that, listen, if I had known this, I mean, you know, is this what you called us for? I hope your hands break. You know? No one else said it. And the reason no one else said it is because the Prophet was from the Hashimi tribe. It was a very strong tribe. No one wants to say anything. Right? They said, I mean, if a slave said that, they would have slaughtered him right there. They would have slaughtered because he came from a very influential tribe and said it. And that also is the wisdom why Allah brought him from a very influential tribe. The reason for that also. But that's not for here. But the fact that he was from an influential tribe, no one could do anything because they knew that if you do something to him, the whole tribe will turn against you. Why? Because they were thinking in the ignorant way. I can't do anything like that. So now everyone got angry. Now they knew he's the one. But how do you stop him? You can't do anything to him because his uncle is the chief of Makkah, Abu Talib. And he was like the chief. He was like the main guy. Everyone's like afraid of him. Like you don't want to deal with him. So how do you now deal with him? How do you stop him? So my friends, the Meccans, obviously, you know, they were not arrogant for no reason. They were smart and they were very clever. And they made a twofold plan to stop this misguidance. They had a plan. On one hand, they had the people who were amongst the Muslims. There were people who were from big tribes and well-known families. And then there are those people who had no tribes and they were slaves or other people. So they made this plan. They said that, you know what? They didn't want to do anything to the people who came from big tribes. Because of that ignorance that, you know, if you do something to someone else's tribe, he's going to get back at you. They wouldn't care if he's a Muslim or not. So they made a plan and they announced amongst the tribes that, listen, they told the chiefs of the tribes, if anyone from your families is a Muslim or becomes a Muslim, then you are responsible for stopping him. Meaning the tribe itself can take care of him. Beat him up, do what you need to do with him, you stop him. We won't interfere in your tribe and in your family. You stop them. Right? So that was one plan. Now for those people who didn't have tribes, who were poor, downtrodden, what about them? They made a plan about them. They said, well, yes, for those who don't have tribes, we will torture them in such a way that they will become an example for everyone else. We will torture them. In such a way, we will act with them in such a way that they will have no recourse. My friend, and this is the way that happened then. This is the way it happens now. Right. Then it was tribes, now it's races. Right? Now it's ethnicity, now it's nationality. Right? If you are a, you know, American, right, and you are caught doing a crime, so obviously you're treated differently than if you're an American citizen. It's two different things, right? You know, I mean, you know, obviously we know that there's an American and there's a American citizen. American citizens are those who became American. They're not equal yet. Alright? But Americans are those who are, for example, as they say, the original, even though they're not. I don't know which imaginary world they're living in, but since they're living in an imaginary world, so they think so. right? But the issue is that you see that they are treated differently. You know, if you are an outsider and you do a crime, yes, you know, you get to go to Gitmo.
Yeah,
right away. Right? Is an American citizen doing that? No, I mean, he can go to a nice jail here. For some time. And maybe we can let him go because he's insane, he's not acting correctly. He shouldn't be doing it, they do it. He shouldn't be doing it. Right? You see, they're different. In that time also, there was tribes and there are people who are non-members of tribes. There is, you know, slaves. You know? And so for the slaves, they had a different treatment. They say, we'll torture them. But for the tribesmen, we'll leave it in their hands. Let them, you know, slap them around. You know? Do what they want with them. My friends, this is the way it began. And now, we come to another realization. And this is not from the time of the Prophet, from before his time. When Islam grows, Islam first grows amongst those who are poor and downtrodden. It first grows towards that. Since the beginning of time, when Nuh was calling the people towards Islam, Prophet Nuh is calling the people towards Islam. So at that point you see, the people of Nuh, they criticized him and they raised this argument against him that Allah puts in the Quran. He puts that argument in the Quran so that we can understand something. He says, those people of Nuh, Prophet Nuh, told Nuh, La ara la ittaba'aka illa arzulana. We don't see anyone who follows you except for the meanest and the lowest amongst us. You know, only the poor people are with you. Why aren't the rich people with you? Someone dignified. These people with you have no dignity. You see that? This is an argument of kufr right from the start, from the time of Nuh. Then in the time of Prophet, we see the argument that the Meccans gave to the Prophet. Allah, He has that also, right, in the ayat of the Quran. He says, Lawla, they told the Prophet, Lawla unzila hadhal Quran ala rajulin min qariyatayn al-azim. Why didn't this Quran, why wasn't this Quran revealed on someone of a greater stature from the two towns of Makkah and Taif? From Makkah and Taif, why wasn't it revealed on a man who comes, who's more dignified? Who's more, you know, by dignified they mean rich. I mean, why did it come on Abu Jahl? You know, Abu Jahl had said, we all would have accepted it. You know? But Abu Sufyan, you know, I mean, but Abu Sufyan, you know? Why didn't it come on him?
Abu Sufyan.
I mean, it came on who? Orphan? An orphan? A poor orphan? I mean, well, he wasn't poor then, but an orphan, still. You know, it wasn't good enough for them. It wasn't good enough for them. And hence what happened is that this is what they came out with. Allah quotes them in the Quran. So this was the attitude that they had. But you see, this is the reality. When Islam is going to spread, it's going to spread amongst those who are poor and downtrodden first. It's not to say that the rich don't have anyone who's good amongst them. No, there are good people amongst those who are rich and influential also. There are those who are good, but mostly the people who will accept Islam are the ones who are poor. The ones who are poor. And you see, the attitude here nowadays, even with those people who want to propagate Islam, right? They refuse to go out in poor areas to propagate Islam because they're afraid those people might accept it.
Yes, yes.
They might accept it and might become a burden.
This is true.
It's true, I mean, this is the way it is. That's why they go to like rich areas, so if they enter Islam, at least they'll bring some more money in. A donation or two, right? This is the attitude in propagating Islam. This is how it has become. You know, they go to rich communities to build Islamic centers there so that they don't have to deal with these burdens of having poor people accept Islam and having to take care of them. They don't want to deal with that. And hence they go there to rich places so that rich people can come be Muslim, and hence, you know, they'll, you know, help the masjid. Instead of the masjid helping them. See, this has been the attitude. And this has become the attitude. But Allah had shown otherwise. He says, these people are not going to accept Islam. They will accept Islam when they will see your army at the gate. Mm. Then Abu Sufyan will say, okay, I'm here, man, forget it. That's history, that's what happened. That's how Allah is showing it to us. Right? He's not going to change that way. This is how it's going to happen, my friends, my brothers and sisters. If we are working for Allah, these are the things we learn from the seerah. So now, the reality is that it is going to be propagated amongst poor people. This is the way it happens. But one of the signs we see in the life, in the propagation of the Prophet. My friends, this is something that we see in his life. And I want you to understand this very well. In his time, when he propagated Islam, and the few people who accepted Islam at first, because of this plan of the kuffar, they went through a lot of tortures. They went through a lot of pain and persecution. But you see that they, no matter how much they went through, none of them left Islam because of persecution. There's a testimony to those early companions of the Prophet, who when they accepted Islam, they accepted it with all their heart. And no matter what tortures they went to, they would not leave Islam. They would rather die, but they will not leave the faith that they found. You see, this is this is a testimony, my friends, you know, looking back at them. You know, after, in the sixth year after Hijrat, after the war happened at Khaybar, and there was a truce between the Meccans and Muslims, the Prophet, he sent letters to the different kings in the regions, you know, different emperors, you know, Persia, Yemen, Sham. In Sham, there was a Christian rule, right, the Eastern Roman Empire, based in Sham. And he sent a letter there also. The ruler there read the letter, you know, and he said that, I mean, what has been said is like the words of prophets, you know. But I want to see who is this person who wrote this letter. So they said, well, he is from Makkah, but he lives in Medina now. You know, he says, I mean, anyone knows him? I'm going to ask some things about him. Right? So go and see if there's anyone from Makkah in my town, right, in the city. Because Sham was a hub for trade. And Meccans usually used to be there, you know, in caravans. So the guards went out to look for a group from Makkah, and lo and behold, the only person they could find was Abu Sufyan. Abu Sufyan came to meet Hercules, that was his name. He came to meet him, and Abu Sufyan, you know, then, so he asked about the Prophet. It's a big hadith, a big riwayat, I'm not going to go into that. But just one thing I want to say from it. One of the questions he asked to find out about the Prophet, one of the questions he asked Abu Sufyan, he says, listen, has there been anyone who had accepted his faith, and but because of their tortures and the hardships you put them through, left his religion? Has there been anyone who left his religion? Abu Sufyan said that these people are crazy. No matter how much we torture them, no matter how much we put them in, a lot of people we killed also, but they will not leave his faith. Abu Sufyan is testifying, and he was an enemy at that time. Abu Sufyan is testifying that the people who are with the Prophet, they will not leave the Prophet. This is a testimony of the Prophet's character and the sincerity of his message. That once people accepted it, that's it, they would not leave. Imagine how he chose those people and he brought them close and he made them so sure and so stable and so strong that no matter how many tortures are put on them, they would not leave the Prophet. When you look back in history of the Anbiya, we look like all the Prophets, their closest companions ran away. When you look at the life of Jesus or Isa, look at his life. And you will see that in his life, in the work that he has done to propagate, there are about 72 people who accepted his faith. 72 people who accepted his faith. And at the end, when he was being looked for and searched, you know, only 12 remained with him. And out of the 12, one of them even betrayed him. Peter. Peter betrayed him and he sold him out. And Jesus said that, "You're going to betray me." Right? And now unfortunately these people say it's Judas. It's not. It's Peter. He's the one who sold him out. And Jesus told him that, "You're going to betray me 3 times. This, my friends, understand this. This is how, when you look at it, this was his companions. They all were running away. But you see, this is a testimony to the Prophet's early companions, who when they came to him, they did not leave him. When they were brought near him and he made them so strong, you see, they did not leave him. This shows their character. This is their character. Now, if you understood that, now you can understand. And inshallah, we will go through those early Muslims one by one. We'll go through them from next week. You know, who were these people and how they accepted Islam and what happened with them. All their history, so that we know what are the oppression of the Quraysh. How they oppressed these people. We'll understand that. But just understand that those people who accepted Islam, this was their sign, they did not leave. And if you can understand how great were these people, then imagine how great were the companions of Hussein. Right? Who showed the same character as that of the Prophet. You know that when they came around and they wouldn't leave him. No matter what happened, they wouldn't leave him. You see, this is what you call when true message is given, true character. That's how it comes about. Right? Except when hypocrisy gets in. Right? When hypocrisy gets in, then even if you have an imam like Ali, then he's left alone. Even when you have an imam like Hassan, he's also left alone. It's because of hypocrisy. Right? It's because of hypocrisy. When hypocrisy took over, then you see how it was. Eradicated the faith of believers. Until Imam Ali and Imam Hassan had to work in order to gain that faith in the people and put that fire of faith in the people so that they can stand with Hussein.
Nare Haydari!
So these are things that we learned from the seerah of the Prophet in relationship to tabligh and propagation. Inshallah, we will go ahead from next week and explaining about the early companions of the Prophet and what they had gone through. Ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give us the tawfiq and the blessing to be on the right path. To give us the wisdom to understand his guidance. Hasten the reappearance of our Imam. To make us his helper when he comes. وآخر الدعوان الحمد لله رب العالمين